Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Discover how you can take charge of the all-new Corsa E on opel.ie.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now we're going to move on because we're joined on the line by the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Claire. You've
details today of this new bill which will outlaw the coercion of children to commit a crime. Will you give us a sense of what the aim is here?
Absolutely. So as you've just outlined, this is legislation that will for the first time allow us to prosecute an adult, and generally what we're aiming for here is people working within criminal gangs where they exploit children, where they coerce them, where they force them into a life of crime and where crimes are committed by these young children. What it doesn't do, or what the legislation currently that we have doesn't do, is take into account the damage that is done to a child. So we have laws whereby a person can be prosecuted if a child has carried out a crime and they have been forced to do so, but it doesn't take into account the serious damage that this does to the child. They're very vulnerable people, some as young as 8 or 9 or 10, and it doesn't, I suppose, it doesn't specifically criminalise that harm done. So what this law will do will allow the Gardaí to prosecute where a crime has been committed, but a separate offence can then be brought forward where this child has been exploited, where they have been groomed over time, as well as the offence of the actual crime itself.
I know some of the legal experts, though, have raised the issue of expecting the child who has committed the crime to give evidence against the adult, and in some cases that adult may be a parent or a brother or a sister.
Do you know, look, I think questions, you know, will be raised as to how this can be done. And obviously with any case, Gardaí need to gather evidence. And I think particularly when you're talking about any type of criminal activity, it is difficult. But from my point of view, that's no reason not to do this. And there's two things here that we're really trying to achieve. Firstly, it's to prevent these young people from being dragged into a life of crime. And, you know, a lot of them, they're being, you know, targeted, they're given nice things, they're told they can have a nice life, something that they can't have without doing this. But, you know, they are victims themselves here. So what we want to do is to show those children, but also their family, their parents, because it's not always within the family, that there is a law there to protect them, but also that the people who are doing this to them can be punished. And the second thing, obviously, I want to do is send a very clear message to these criminal gangs that we won't allow them to do this. So, you know, I know this can be difficult, and I think the legislation in itself won't be enough. So there's a huge amount of work that's happening. Mm-hmm. Firstly, we had a report that was commissioned back in 2016, specifically looking at the influence of criminal networks on children in Ireland, and very clearly showing that a small number of children, their level of offending increased once they were influenced by these criminal networks, and the use of coercive control is how this is happening. What the report has recommended is that we would design a programme which very much includes interventions with children, with their families, to help them withstand this type of influence of criminal networks. And based on that huge level of research, we have already started, just in the last few weeks, two pilot programmes, taking all of this evidence, taking a lot of work from international experts on crime, on child protection, welfare, drugs, and we've started these pilots and put a lot of money behind it to try and make sure that we're not just introducing laws, that we're actually putting support within communities to work with the children, their families, and to steer them away from this type of life.
One of the things you said there earlier was that, you know, these children are told that they can have nice things. And one of the reasons why crime is attractive to these children is because they're coming from a place of disadvantage, where they may see that a nice life with nice things is not attainable for these people.
Absolutely. And I mean, the legislation is just one piece here. So it is really important that just because, you know, it might be difficult to get convictions, it's important that we do this and we send a clear message. But it's important that we also try and address some of the root causes, as you say. And I've said, you know, they're offered nice things as they get older. They're maybe sent on nice holidays. But we know this doesn't lead anywhere good. We know that for many of these children, they end up in jail or in some instances, even worse. What we're trying to do, so the Greentown Project being one of them, a youth justice strategy, which myself and my colleague James Brown will be launching in the coming weeks. But as well as that, we have individual work that has been done in areas where we have identified significant problems. So you have the former Assistant Garda Commissioner, Jack Nolan, commissioned a report for the area of Darndale and surrounding areas, setting out a socioeconomic and a community plan for that area, and that work is due to start. We have a piece of work by Vivian Guerin in Drogheda, which again I have a preliminary report and hope to publish the full report in the coming weeks, again setting out how can we work with communities, how can we improve the supports that are there, particularly for younger people, how can we invest, how can we make sure that when these gangs, when these criminals essentially target these young vulnerable people, that they know there is another route, that they know there is another option. And that's not easy. And I think, you know, collectively, if we can manage to implement all of this, we'll be doing a lot of good for these younger people who really, you know, the impact on their lives is absolutely detrimental.
I want to talk to you about the report from the Mother and Baby Homes Commission this week, because the issue that relates directly to your own portfolio in justice is the commitment that is asserted should be made to address this issue around adopted people getting access to their own information. Now, what can you and your department do in that regard?
Well, look, I think firstly, I mean, this obviously Minister O'Gorman is very much the minister in the lead of this report and a lot of the actions that follow on from this. But in terms of providing information for survivors and for people who are adopted and people who have gone through these homes, what Minister O'Gorman wants to do is to introduce this via legislation and to do this as soon as possible. And so he is working with the AG, he's working with a lot of the representative groups, a lot of the women who have gone through this to try and make sure that we can do this as soon as possible. So that is the intention, that it is done through legislation and that, you know, any of the information that we're talking about here, that people will have access to it. Obviously, there have been questions raised over the last while around GDPR and making sure that it's, you know, that people access their own information and information that's appropriate to them.
Well, it's balancing rights, though, isn't it? It's balancing rights of the adopted person against the rights of the birth mother, who in many cases, or in some cases certainly, won't want to have their identity revealed to their birth children.
Absolutely. And I mean, look, we're in a very difficult situation. And I mean, anybody who's read even some of the summaries of the reports, you know, this is not a good time in our history. This is, you know, where society has entirely failed, not just the children and the people who are now looking for their information, but the mothers as well. And you have many stories and instances where, you know, people had children and they went on and they got married and they held up their lives and people know nothing about what happened to them in the past. So it's a very difficult issue to try and address and to make sure, as you say, that we get the right balance here. But it is really important that people have access to their information, that they know who they are and where they came from. And I know, as I've said, Minister Gorman is very keen that we will progress this, that we will have legislation and that we can hopefully do it through legislation and that it's done as soon as possible.
You don't think a referendum would be necessary?
Well, again, the information that I have is that this should be manageable through legislation. I can't rule that out, obviously, but again, I think if we can do this through legislation, I think that's the route that we should go on, and obviously would be the easier route. If I could, you know, none of this is easy, but it would be the easier route. But I mean, obviously what happened this week with the publication of the report, you know, access to information is just one element of this, and you know, acknowledging the failures of the state, moving to make sure people have access to their information, that the redress scheme. So there's a lot of things that we need to now move on and make sure that, you know, acknowledging what happened in the past, trying to make sure that we can bring some bit of solace or closure to these women, but also making sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
You said there in your comments on the report that society has had entirely failed, and the Taoiseach's words in that regard, that we did this to ourselves as a society, that notion is not appreciated by survivors, and some of them have been very hurt by that. Fionn Davenport, who spoke to us on this programme, he said, if everyone is to blame, then no one is to blame.
Well, look, I think what the Taoiseach was trying to say here, because it's, you know, it's very easy to blame one group of people or to say that this was the church or this was, you know, the institutions. But I think what he was acknowledging was that this was a failure of many people and many groups in society. And I think he was acknowledging that, and obviously the state apologising on behalf of all of those who were involved in this. That is what the Taoiseach was trying to do there. It wasn't to take away blame from anybody or to say, well, you know, we're sorry, everybody was involved here and we couldn't do much about it. There were very clear failures. You know, and obviously every case was different, every situation was different, and what the report tried to do was to get to the bottom of that, to unearth what happened here, and as I've said, to try and respond to, and where possible, and obviously from my own department's point of view, you know, if there are, and obviously there are certain bars that are set, but if there are any types of prosecutions or anything that needs to happen subsequently, then obviously that work can be done and will of course be done. But, you know, this is about acknowledging that this was a failure by a lot of people in society, and it's not to take away the blame from any one person, but what happened was wrong. What happened should not have happened, and the Taoiseach, I think, was simply just acknowledging that.
I want to talk to you about COVID now. How are you doing after your diagnosis?
I'm good, thank you. Yes, I'm good. I'm much better this week. I suppose I was a bit up and down last week, really, and what started off with just a little bit of a cough and feeling under the weather, it, you know, things can develop very quickly in that. So, but you know, I'm much better this week, but also very conscious that, as with a lot of people, the virus has a tendency to make people feel okay, and I think particularly the tiredness and the fatigue. And some of the other symptoms continue long after maybe people have gone past the 12 or the 14 days. So,
Well, especially as you're pregnant, you know, I mean, I don't think we've heard of many cases where people contracted COVID-19 and were pregnant. I know there was one case in ICU last week, but it must be a particular concern. It has to be for you.
Well, look, I mean, the first thing I would say, and I had, this is something that I had read up on, and I suppose I was very keen to understand before I tested positive, that this doesn't seem to have any effect on pregnant women. And unfortunately, I do know somebody else close to me who's pregnant who got this as well, and she is fine, and I am fine, and I had a scan this week, and everything seems to be fine. So I think all the indicators and the evidence shows this doesn't have a negative impact on the baby. But at the same time, you know, it's very clear, and listening to Coleman, who was speaking before me, even people who are young and fit and healthy, this virus is impacting people in different ways. And if the mother is not well, then obviously the knock-on consequences, you know, you need to try and make sure that you stay fit and healthy for your baby. So, look, I mean, it was, you know, it's worrying to get it in the first instance, because nobody knows how they will respond to it. But thankfully, as I said, I'm feeling much better. And, you know, thankfully, the vast majority of people who are fit and healthy do recover very well from this.
Well, that's good news. And you mentioned your scan there, and I'm going to ask you about it because I know you wrote about it publicly on social media. And it's very difficult for pregnant women who are having scans, because it's a joyful time, but you can't have your partner with you. And then there's also the risk or the worry, the concern that if you get bad news, and you know, I'm glad that you said everything went well, that you're on your own.
And look, and I get that, and I suppose I'm very lucky that I haven't had any bad news, but I haven't had my husband Paul with me at any of the scans, and it is difficult, and you do want to have somebody there with you. But I suppose the reason that we're doing this, and the reason these tough decisions are being taken, and we have to adhere to them, is because we're trying to protect, I suppose, ourselves. We're trying to protect the people who are working, our doctors, nurses, our midwives, the team and staff in our hospitals. And we're trying to make sure that we don't pass it on to anybody else. So I know it's really difficult, and I know, you know, a lot of people have found it very challenging. And as you say, particularly for those who do not receive good news. But a lot of this, you know, this has been done to make sure that we can all get through this, and that we try and limit the spread of this. And of course, we know with the new variant that is there, this is transmitting much more easily, and the rate at which it is transmitting has increased significantly since it's come into this country. So everything that we're doing, as difficult as it might be, it's to protect ourselves and our babies and our partners and the teams who are working with us and people beyond that as well.
And you'll be the first minister to have a baby while serving at Cabinet. And of course, there was an issue raised at the time when you made your announcement that, you know, you're not entitled to any maternity leave. Is that being addressed?
So this is something I'm working through with colleagues and with government at the moment. There is no provision for ministers, for TDs, for senators to take maternity leave. And I mean, it's not a very encouraging signal for women who want to get into politics, particularly as we have more younger women getting into politics. So I'm working with them at the moment. But what's really important is that there isn't just, you know, a mechanism put in place for me, that we can set out clearly a plan for future TDs and senators and hopefully cabinet ministers who may get pregnant and want to take that maternity leave. Mm-hmm. So we're not quite there yet. As I said, I'm working with them to make sure that obviously I'm able to take maternity leave, but that it's not just about me, that it's the much broader picture, because, you know, if we want more women and younger women to get into politics, we need to show them that this is an option and it's possible for them.
But it won't be fixed, like there won't be a long-term solution in place for you, but from what you said just there, you are going to take some leave, are you?
Absolutely, I am. And as I said, it's something that we're still working through, and whether or not we have the long-term picture in place by the time I take that leave, I'm not sure if we will, but I think what's important is that we can set out a plan and that we know that this is going to change, because I do have colleagues and I have a colleague very close to me in County Cavan who had a baby not too long ago, and unfortunately that option wasn't available to her. So this cannot pass. While this has arisen because of me, this cannot pass where we don't make permanent changes for absolutely everybody. So I'm absolutely determined that we will do that.
So will there be a period of time around when your baby is born when you will not be serving as Minister for Justice?
So again, look, I suppose until we work that through and get into the detail of it, I don't think it would be right to maybe say what may or may not happen. But what I can say is that I am going to take paternity leave. I am going to take time off. I do want to, this is my first child, I do want to take that time. But we do need to identify a mechanism by which that can happen. It's not straightforward, I will say that. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's maybe taking a bit of time and I haven't been able to say anything yet. But I am working to try and address that. And obviously, as I've said, if something more permanent can't be put in place by then, what I hope is that obviously we can clearly set out a plan and outline what that will look like for people coming down the line.
I think people will be glad to hear that you're not going to rush back to work, because the one thing that we all learn after our children are born is that you never get that time back again.
No, and you know, as I said, this is my first child, and you know, even if it wasn't, I think that those first few weeks and those first few months, I have a brother who had a baby recently, his wife, my sister, and you know, you can see how quickly that time goes and how important that time is. So whether you're in politics or not, I think everybody should be entitled to that time. And obviously that our partners and my husband and that others should be entitled to time as well. And that's obviously an area that we're looking to develop, and I'm working with my colleague, Minister Gorman, to try and make sure that we have that access for fathers as well to take time. But, you know, I think it is important that we set that example, and the fact that there is no provision there, you know, in this day and age, really, it's simply not acceptable.
Let's talk about policing now around the COVID restrictions, because the Gardaí told us yesterday that they fined three people who went from Meath to Dublin to pick up a burger. Now, I know that sounds as though it wasn't an essential journey, but I remember back when all this started that I'm sure the rule was that you could collect food outside of the 2K or the 5K, whatever the limit was at the time.
So, and that still is the case. I mean, I live in the country. There's a lot of people who don't even have a shop within five kilometres of where they live. So the rules are very clear. You're to stay within the 5 kilometres for exercise. But if you need to get foods, whether it's, you know, dropping to the shop to get smaller items, whether it's doing a bigger shop, or even if it's getting a takeaway, people are allowed to do that. But I mean, where it's absolutely not necessary, I mean, you know, there are plenty of places of County Meath, in County Meath, where people can buy burgers. The idea that people travelled 80 kilometres to the other side of a different county, it's not necessary. It's not essential travel. And if everybody were to take that view or opinion, I mean, we've seen the traffic numbers reduce significantly, which is very positive. But if everybody were to take that approach, the amount of people on our roads would be back to where we were before Christmas. So, you know, it might seem harsh and it might seem, well, they were only picking up food, but people are asked to do that within their vicinity, to travel to maybe the closest shop, to the nearest takeaway, you know, and 80 kilometres, you know, as rural as you might be, 80 kilometres is certainly not the closest. So, I mean, look, that's one example. Obviously, we've seen in the last week, there have been a number of prosecutions and fixed charge notices where people, you know, where they have told the guards they're going somewhere and they've been later found on a beach or somewhere where they shouldn't be. I would ask people, you know, please adhere to what we've set out here. You know, the guards are not there to try and enforce these regulations. They are still applying the graduated policing response. That's to engage with people, to educate them about the rules that are there, to encourage them to comply. And it's only as an absolute last resort that they're enforcing these measures.
So is that why only 29 fines have been issued?
So I think the figure, particularly for the travel restrictions, we had 37 last week, and then there was other numbers around face coverings and face masks. So, I mean, this really has only started in the last week or two where we have the fixed charge notice. But if you look at overall enforcement proceedings, which begun, obviously, we're talking 10 months now, we have over 1,000 different incidents where enforcement proceedings have begun. That's everything from licensed premises, so pubs or restaurants. There's retail included in that. Then you have fixed penalty notices and then some other charges as well. So, you know, we are seeing different enforcement proceedings begin. But, you know, again, this is not the way that the Gardaí want to work. They have done a huge amount of work over the last few months engaging with people and supporting them and helping them and educating mm-hmm. them as to what they should be doing.
I don't know if you've had contact from constituencies about vaccine rollout, but we're getting a lot of feedback here from people who say we're hearing that from the 24th of January, which is only 9 days away, there will be community rollout, but we don't know how to book in. We don't know how we will be contacted. We don't know who will be administering that vaccine. I mean, is it time, high time now for a plan for these people?
Well, look, I think there's maybe been criticism in recent days around the communication of how this has been rolled out. And, you know, we all have to take responsibility for that and in government. But, you know, there is a very clear plan in place as to what's happening over the next few months. We have a committee that was established specifically to put this plan in place and to make sure that the vaccine is rolled out. And what we've said is between now and the end of March, we're looking at the first three categories. So that's our frontline healthcare workers, it's those who are in long-term care facilities, and then those who are over 70. And to date, we have 77,000 people who've been vaccinated. You have about 70,000 of those who are our frontline healthcare workers. This week, there's going to be a significant increase in vaccinations across the long-term care facilities, and then obviously including those who are over 70 as part of that. After that, then, we start moving into the next category. So you have people who are working in healthcare, but not necessarily on the front line. You have those over 65, and then we move into categories of key workers.
So yeah, it's just we don't know how those over 65 will be booked in, contacted, and where they're going to go yet. And it just seems as though the timeline is very short now to organise that. But I want to move on to one more issue with you, because from 4 o'clock this morning, the UK banned travel from South America and Portugal because of concerns over this new strain, this new Brazilian variant of coronavirus. Why haven't we done the same?
Well, firstly, what I would say is we have introduced new rules around travel. And initially, this was brought in for South Africa and Great Britain, where you could not travel here without essentially going through a system within the Department of Foreign Affairs and then subsequently without a PCR test. We are now extending that from midnight on Saturday this week to absolutely everybody. So no matter where you're coming from in the world, whether it's a green zone or outside of the EU, you have to produce this test. What's also different here is that we've asked and worked with the ferries and the airlines to make sure that nobody would actually be allowed board a plane without having these tests. So we are moving to quite significant measures to try and make sure that there's nobody coming into this country okay. that cannot produce a clear test. You know, obviously, at the same time, and you've mentioned some countries there, all of this is kept under constant review. And if we need to change this, if we need to strengthen this even further, then that's something that we of course, will look at.
Minister, thank you for joining us on the programme. Minister Helen McEntee. We'll be checking in with two homeschoolers after the break, see how they're getting on. It's Friday of the first week of this lockdown. We'll check out how emergency education is going for them.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.